So now we're going to look at faith for just a few minutes to start with. I'd like for us to begin in Hebrews 11 and verse 1. And we're going to spend a little bit of time here. And I would like for you to consider this a bit of a refresher on what biblical faith really is. I often talk about minding your faith. And what I mean by that is you're thinking about your faith. You're taking care of your faith. You're building up your faith. It's not just simply proving it, but you're taking care of it and thinking about it and understanding it better. So the Scripture says that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. You know, there are various terms that we find, we run into with the world, that they will use the word very differently from the way we understand it, or from the way the Bible uses it. And faith is one of those words. If you talk about faith with somebody today in the culture, you might find that they mean something very different by it than what you might mean by it. For example, they might say something like, faith is believing in spite of or without evidence. And so it kind of gives this impression that faith is just the arbitrary thing that you choose, and you don't really have any evidence for it, so you just believe no matter what. Or that faith and reason are at odds with one another. And I've heard people say things like, well, we have reason and you have faith. We have science and you have faith. And that, you know, again, faith is superstition and science is knowledge. And so you have this kind of dichotomy between the two, and they might say, well, in science we don't use faith, we don't have faith, it doesn't have anything to do with anything. And so you have these different ideas in culture about what faith is, and so we're trying to understand how we can engage our culture a little bit better by understanding what faith is a little bit better. And sometimes I've run into Christians who have some of these similar ideas, and so we have to kind of take stock in our understanding of what faith really is. So our task here in a couple things is to, first we're going to debunk false concepts and establish a biblical working definition of faith. And what that means is we're going to get our understanding of faith out of the Bible itself to see what it says. Because a lot of times when people, again, characterize faith as being something that is without evidence or whatever, They're not doing it from an understanding of what the Bible actually says about faith. We need to understand what it says about faith. And encourage true faith in such a way that it reflects our trust in God. My goal in doing anything with apologetics or evidences is never simply to say, let's just do this to win an argument. It's always that we have a practical end here. And when it comes to faith, we want to encourage be encouraged to live in a way that we're demonstrating our trust in God on a daily basis. Because that's where it's really practical for us. And that's why it's so important. So come back to that statement there. In verse 1 of Hebrews chapter 11, and also in verse 6 of Hebrews chapter 11, that faith without faith is impossible to please God. For he that comes to God or would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And so we kind of start with that basic understanding. Faith is the evidence or the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction, or some translations will say, evidence of things not seen. And we'll come back to that and talk a little bit about what that means. I also want to draw your attention to a passage in John chapter 20. And particularly verses 29 through 31. You might recall that this is one of the occasions where Jesus appears to his disciples after he has been raised from the dead. And Thomas is the one who basically says, I'm not going to believe unless I see, unless I can touch. So he actually has one of those mentalities that says, I refuse to have faith. I refuse to believe unless I can put my hands on it. And that's not uncommon to what you might find people say today. I'm not going to believe unless I can actually see it for myself, actually test it for myself. And so Jesus appears that second time and tells him, in verse 27, reach here with your finger, see my hands, reach here with your hand, put it into my side, do not be unbelieving but believing. And Thomas' response in verse 28 was, my Lord and my God. The only really proper response that he could have at that point. And Jesus said in verse 29, because you've seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believe. That's a significant statement. And he's telling us that it is possible, certainly, to believe without necessarily being the one who sees for yourself, without being the one who's touched him or put your hand in his side or anything like that. You can actually have the evidence available to you that you can believe. And there's a blessing in that. And that, you know, we're used to quoting verses 30 and 31. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you may have life in His name. Now, we often quote those two verses, but it's very much tied to what He just said to Thomas. Have you believed because you've seen? Blessed are those who haven't seen and yet believe. Because John is basically saying, I'm writing to you who will not be able to see firsthand. I want you to have the evidence. I want you to see it through faith and understand that Jesus did these things, and He did these things so that you may believe that He's the Christ, and through that you're going to have life in His name. And so there is a special blessing, if you will, of being able to believe even though we haven't firsthand been the ones to witness Him. And yet John is saying, I'm still providing the evidence for you. It is still being written down. It is still here. It is not faith without or apart from evidence. The evidence is right here. He says this is written down for that very purpose. Also want to draw your attention to what Peter wrote in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 13 through 15. And this is just kind of a general recognition of why it's so important that we be ready to give a defense. In the context of talking about the problem of suffering among Christians and being ready and willing, armed with that ability to suffer, who is there to harm you, he says, if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being ready to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason of the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and respect. Now, what's interesting to me there is that the word for defense or reason, some translations will say there, is the word from which we get apology. Sometimes you'll hear us talk about apologetics or giving an apology. It's not being sorry for something in this context. It's giving a verbal defense of something. Paul used the same word in Philippians 1, 16 and 17 when he said, I'm set for the defense of the gospel. I'm set for the apology of the gospel. We're not out here telling people we're sorry about the gospel. That's not the point. We are, however, willing to give a verbal defense, but that starts with putting Christ in your heart. You have to have Christ in your heart as holy, sanctified, set apart. He's Lord in your heart. He's Lord over all, but you've got to make Him Lord of your heart. And that's where the preparation really begins. Because at that point, then, you're willing to step up and say, I will offer a defense for the reason of the hope that is in me. Now, that concept of hope, we could take back to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3. We've been born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead to an inheritance that is incorruptible, undefiled, will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith. And so that faith is tied to the hope that we have, and that hope is something that we are willing to give a defense of because we have set Christ apart as Lord in our hearts, and this is our life. This is what we're willing to give, and in the context of 1 Peter, it's we're willing to suffer for His sake if that's what it takes. Now, with that kind of there in mind, I want to go back then to Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Where again he says that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And again, some translations say the evidence of things not seen. And maybe you've heard something along these lines. Well, faith has evidence attached to it. And so Hebrews 11 and verse 1 says, to have faith, you have to have evidence. That's really not what he's saying in this context, though. What he's saying is that faith itself is the evidence. Faith is the evidence. What is faith the evidence of? It's the evidence that you have a conviction about things that you haven't actually seen. So he's saying here that faith is what stands under your hope, and it demonstrates the conviction and the trust we have in the reality of what we cannot see. We are saying that even though we haven't seen it firsthand, we're not saying there's no evidence. We're simply saying that we believe in the reality of something that we haven't actually seen for ourselves firsthand with our own eyes. But that doesn't mean there's no evidence for it. It just means that we haven't actually seen the thing itself. And so our question here then is, well, how then do we have a reasonable faith? If this is the nature of faith, that it's really meant to demonstrate a conviction in the reality of those things we haven't actually seen, then how can we have faith that is reasonable? And I would suggest to you tonight three things. You might think of more, but I'll give you three things that really are involved in the reasonable nature of our faith. First, there has to be some understanding of what we're talking about. Now, in our second session tonight, we're going to spend some time in Acts 17, so I won't spend too much time in that right now. But I would just have you think about the fact that when Paul stands before the Athenians and he says to them, I want you to know about the God you don't know. In other words, I see all these altars and idols and I see you're very religious and that's great, but here's this altar to the unknown God and I want to talk about that. If we're going to talk about God, then we have to understand something about that. Now again, we'll talk more about that in the second session, but we can't talk about what we know nothing about. So we have to be a student of who God is. And that's really significant to us. There has to be some understanding of what we're talking about. But how is that any different from anything else in life? If you're going to talk about it, you've got to have some understanding of it. Otherwise, you've got really nothing to say. Secondly, faith is very much tied to action in the Bible. And there needs to be a readiness to act. And I would just cite James chapters 1 and 2, really the whole thing, because practically that's what James is talking about, is the practical nature of what faith does. You are doers of the Word, not merely hearers deluding your own selves. And you don't just look in a mirror and walk away, but you're actually concerned about what it says so that you can do it. And you go into chapter 2, faith without works is dead. And it's in the context of making sure that you're helping those in need, so you're acting upon the faith that you are professing. So faith is not something that we're simply saying, I have a mental assent toward this. I just accept in my mind that there's a God. Or I accept in my mind that Jesus is the Son of God, but it really goes no further than that. That's not biblical faith. So when people characterize faith as something that's just kind of a mental thing, that's really not the biblical concept of it all. There is an understanding about it, and there's a willingness and a readiness to act on it. We could cite, go back to 1 Peter chapter 3 again, where he's talking about the fact that we're setting Christ apart in our hearts as Lord, and we're giving a defense for the reason of the hope that's within us, and we're willing to suffer for it. We're willing to go that distance. Chapter 4, arm yourselves with that same attitude that Jesus had, be willing to suffer. So there has to be a readiness to act. If we're going to have a biblical faith, there needs to be a readiness to act on that. And thirdly, a reason for acceptance. We've already cited 1 Peter 3:15. But I love the situation there in John 6 when Jesus is telling the crowds there, I'm the bread who's come down out of heaven. He's fed the 5,000 there at the beginning of chapter 6. He gives those teachings about himself being the bread of life. And he says, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. Well, there are many there who misunderstood that. In fact, I would say one of John's themes is the misunderstood Jesus. It's over and over, every chapter, they misunderstand something about Jesus and what he said. Chapter 6 is no exception to that. Jesus was misunderstood, but many people turned and walked away from him because of what he said. And he turns to his disciples and he says, are you going to leave too? And Peter gives that brilliant statement, one of his brilliant statements. And he says, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. and we have come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. In other words, Peter's saying there's a reason why we're staying. There's a reason why we're sticking this out, because we understand that life is only going to come through you and we have nowhere else to go. And really, if we could come to that point, imagine how many people's faith would be saved. If we reach that point where we could say, where else can we go? This is the only path to life. This is the only way to go. Jesus is it. And we're going to profess that and demonstrate that by our faith. And so there's a reason why we stay. There's a reason why we stick it out, even when there are difficulties and trials and problems that we face, and sometimes even doubts that creep in. We're going to stay. We're going to stick it out because we know there's nowhere else to go, but only through Jesus can we have life. So those three things kind of put together tell us that faith involves the intellect. There's the use of the mind here. And let's understand that faith is not meant to be something that is just kind of some superstitious thing. Faith has an intellectual aspect to that. God gave us minds. He gave us minds to think things out and think things through, and He expects us to use our minds properly. Love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, Jesus said. And so the mind is very much involved in our faith. There's an intellectual aspect to it. But it is not merely intellectual. There's also an emotional aspect to our faith. There's a sensitive reaction to that. We're not trying to say here that you just have to be some kind of stoic person to be a Christian, and you never demonstrate emotion or anything like that. Emotions are very much part of who we are. Now, you understand that there's a difference between having your emotions lead you and having emotions follow the truth. Truth needs to come first. Truth needs to be the driving factor. Instead of, you know, we live in a society that's pretty much a go-by-your-feelings kind of a society. And so if my feelings tell me this, it must be right. Well, that's not necessarily the case at all. Emotions are important, feelings are important, but they have to follow truth, not lead truth. And so those are there, but that's not enough for biblical faith. In fact, I think, you know, if we think back to what James said in James 2 and verse 19, he said this, you know, you believe that God is one, you do well, even the demons believe and shudder. The demons had an intellectual kind of faith. I mean, they intellectually knew who Jesus was. And I think it's interesting that there are occasions when Jesus is performing miracles and the demons will say to him, "We know who you are." Even before the Pharisees would or others would, demons are saying, "We know who Jesus is." And they're recognizing his authority and they're recognizing his power, something some of the Pharisees wouldn't do. But the demons also had an emotional reaction. They shuddered. It affected them emotionally. But who's going to say, therefore demons are saved? Because they have faith. They intellectually believe it and they emotionally have a reaction to it. Well, that's not good enough. And you know, I have sat across table with people studying where, you know, they'll say they recognize, they know this is what the Bible teaches. They'll recognize the truth of it, maybe even shed a tear over it, have an emotional reaction to it, but then do nothing else. I've seen people stand in pews knowing they need to obey the gospel. They're crying about it, but they still do nothing about it. That's not good enough. Emotional reactions are fine, but there still has to be more. There has to be the will. That's the action part again. That's the putting it into practice. That I have to engage the will to do what I know the Lord wants me to do. And so when I know God's will, I have to engage my will to submit myself to His will and do what He wants. So faith is going to involve the intellect, the emotion, and the will. This is all engaging. It's who we are. We are people of intellect. We are people of emotion. We are people of will. And all of this needs to come under submission to Jesus Christ. That's what faith is going to be. Now, we said that there needs to be a reasonable aspect to our faith. But there are some things that faith does not require. And I want us to be clear about that as well, because we're not saying that, for example, that we have to understand everything. There needs to be some understanding. But there are some things that we're not going to understand. So Ephesians 3 and verse 20, which again we'll spend a little bit more time with later, makes that point that God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything that we can ask or think. There are things God can do that we don't have the capacity to think. So while we're going to say there are things about God He has given us to understand, we understand from that there are also things about God we'll never fully grasp. There are things that are incomprehensible to us because of who God is. That's the nature of who God is. He is greater than our minds are capable of fully grasping. So we're not saying faith requires you to understand everything. And even though there may be things about obedience, and you might say, well, I don't understand everything about this, we don't have to understand everything. And I think that's important because, I've talked to people and they might say, well, I just don't think I understand enough. And they're thinking, yeah, I've got to know what 666 in Revelation means before I can obey the gospel. There are things we don't have to fully get just yet. When you get the basics and you understand your need to submit to the Lord, you do it, and you do it now, just like the jailer in the same hour of the night, you do it. And then you grow. You become a Christian. You're a babe in Christ. You grow in grace and knowledge and truth. And that's going to take some time. But we don't understand everything, and that's okay. It's okay to say, I don't know. And we don't have to know every why that things happen. Job is a good example of this. You know, if you were to step into Job's situation and ask him, Job, do you understand why you're suffering? What do you think he'd say? He didn't understand it. I don't know. And you know, God never steps in and says, let me explain it to you. When God does step in Job 38, what He says to Job and the friends basically is, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? In other words, what He's saying is, you guys have no clue what you're talking about. And you're just going to have to trust me. You weren't there when I created everything. You don't understand how it all works. You're just going to have to trust me. And that's where the trust comes in. I don't have to know everything, and I don't have to understand everything in order to put my trust in God. And I think that's important for us to understand. I mean, people come up and say, well, why did this happen to my grandmother? Why did this happen to my father? Why did this... I don't know. I can't tell all the specifics about that. But that doesn't mean God isn't there. And the Bible tells us enough to realize that God has bigger plans and purposes than we sometimes will understand. And that's okay. Nor does it require that we physically see. And that brings us back then full circle to John 20. And verse 29. You know, blessed are those who haven't seen and yet have believed. But that's not, again, an uncommon thing. We don't treat everything else this way. So, for example, think about a court of law for a moment. If you're on a jury in a court of law, what that is necessarily going to mean is you didn't witness the thing that's under trial. You didn't see it yourself. And you're being asked to bring a judgment based on the evidence that is presented. And so you might have documents. Maybe there's some eyewitnesses that come forward. You're not one of the eyewitnesses, because if you were, you'd be on the stand as an eyewitness and not a juror. But you're still being asked to listen to the evidence being presented, the eyewitnesses presenting their case. You're listening to comprehensive explanations. You're getting a cumulative case about something. You're going to reason to the best explanation of what's going on here. You're going to try to explain everything together. And the question is simply one of reasonable doubt. Not beyond a shadow of a doubt even, but beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the way a court of law would work today. My point is that you're still, if you're in that situation as a juror, you're exercising some faith. Because you're trusting that the evidence that's coming forward is either good or bad. You're making judgments about that. You're judging based on your own reasoning skills, whether or not that's good information, bad information, and all of that. But that's the way it works. And in a lot of ways, by analogy, there's this. What we're looking at with here is we're looking at documents, we're looking at eyewitnesses, we're looking at cumulative cases and comprehensive explanations and inference to the best explanations and all of that, very similar kind of thing, and we're making judgments about that. Or, how do we know anything historically? Let me ask you this. How many are certain you know who the first president of the United States was? You're certain. Were you there? Did you see it? Were you at the inauguration? I mean, if you were, I'd like to talk to you. And that'd be really cool. Why do you feel so certain about that? Well, because you say, well, because that's what history tells us. The historical documentation, there were eyewitnesses, things were written down, it's been brought forward. Yeah, we understand this is the way history works. Yes, sometimes history can be distorted. But generally speaking, when something has been well established, we say, yes, that's something that we can trust. We weren't there, we didn't see it, but we trust the reality of what we didn't see. That's faith. And I even would bring that into our own personal families. And I don't mean to sound flippant here, but how many of you are certain you know who your mother is? Now, I ask that because my mother is heavy into genealogy. She traces things out and researches them, and she'll go to different states and to graveyards and research family members, and I mean, she does all this. And she called me up one day and she said, I'd like you to get a DNA test. Now, how many of you have tested whether or not, you know, your family is your family? I said, Mom, I don't want to go into the system, but she said, look, I need you to do this because I'm trying to cross connect this family with this over here, and we're trying to get this. So I said, okay, I'll do it for you. And sure enough, she's my mother. There was no doubt about that. But my point is, I mean, I'm not going to say you weren't there when you were born, but do you remember it? I mean, if I were a conspiracy theorist, I could come up with all kinds of ways that might mean that maybe you were lied to, or maybe you got switched at birth, or maybe something else happened and they lost your records, and maybe, you know. And you might say, well, that's getting kind of silly, isn't it? Yeah? Yeah, it is. But you still accept some things by faith, don't you? Everybody does. And this is part of my point. You don't get to escape life without faith. Everybody has faith. Everybody trusts in something that they didn't personally see or witness. And even those who are going to try to take, in their view, a scientific explanation of everything, I don't know of anybody who has tested every piece of information that's out there and verified it. No, they're going to say, well, that was tested by this person over here. Oh, so you trust what somebody else said, right? Even though you didn't personally see it. Yeah, that's right. That's called faith. There is still faith being exercised in the process. So it's not uncommon. And we're not saying that biblical faith is something that is so different from everything else. We're simply expressing it toward God in this case. And the written documentation tells us this. Luke chapter 1, verse 1. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. Now, you may or may not like Luke. You might say, I don't think Luke is right. Okay, you have the right to say that, or you have the right to think that. What you can't do is say Luke is starting a mythological tale of something. This is not a once upon a time kind of story or beginning, is it? He says, he lets us know right up front, his purpose for writing is to let you know exactly what happened. He has a historical purpose, and he says, I have investigated this carefully from the beginning, and this has been followed by eyewitnesses, and it's been handed down, and I want you to know the exact truth about the things that have been accomplished among us. That is a historical claim that he begins with, and so we have to assume that was his intent. We would do that with anybody else any other ancient work, any other ancient writing, we would say, well, we have to grant that this is what their intention was. And you may disagree with it, but this is the intention, and we have to evaluate it on those grounds. So we evaluate it on historical grounds like we would anything else. And what this tells us is that Scripture, the scriptural approach to this, is going to be an historical approach. It's going to be an approach that is based on evidence. Even Jesus pointed to evidence. For example, in Matthew the 11th chapter, when John sent some disciples to Jesus and asked him, "Are you the coming one, or should we look for somebody else?" And Jesus says, "I want you to tell John the things you've seen and heard." That's evidential. Look at what you see, listen to what you hear, and you tell John that, he'll make an evaluation of that. So, there's some evidence. In John 5, he points to several different witnesses to make sure. The Father, the Spirit, the Father and Moses and the Scriptures. And so, several pieces of evidence that come together that all point to Jesus. And this is not the only place in Luke 1 where eyewitness claims are being made. It's several different places. In 1 John chapter 1, 1 through 4, he says several times, what we saw, what we heard, what we touched, and we've seen, we've heard, we've touched. He says it for emphasis. Or Peter in 2 Peter 1, 16 and 17, talking about making known the power and majesty of our Lord. He says, we were eyewitnesses of His majesty. Talking there about the transfiguration. Now, either they're just blatant liars, or they're really severely deluded, or they're telling the truth. We've got to make decisions about that. But you can't say they're just wholesale making things up, because that's not what fits the evidence. So as in every other area of life, these things work together. Whether it be documentation, eyewitness accounts, other explanations that help us understand what's been passed down and so on, these things work together to provide for us a sense of certainty, what we call moral certainty. This is not math, but this is a moral certainty that we come to these conclusions based on faith, because we do believe that the evidence is there to tell us who Jesus was. And we'll be saying more about that through the weekend. By Sunday, we'll be talking a little bit about the resurrection, and the evidence is the point to that as well. But this is not about scientific testing. It's about understanding the history. It's about understanding the process. It's about understanding the claims. And faith is the evidence. And that brings us back then to the fact that faith is something that is to be expressed. It is the evidence. It is the demonstration of our conviction and trust in the reality of what we cannot see. And this is why Paul would say in 2 Corinthians 4, 16 through 5:10, that's the whole section really, we walk by faith, not by sight. He's not saying we're blind, but he's saying that our choices in walking here are going to be based upon things we haven't ultimately seen, but that's been part of his point. We look not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. The things that are seen are temporary. The things that are not seen are eternal. And we're making a choice between the temporary and the eternal. And I want to choose the eternal. Because the temporary is just that. It will pass away. It will be gone in a flash. And that's the point of the Kohelet and Ecclesiastes. Everything is vain. Everything is fleeting. It's here and it's gone and it's done. So fear God and keep His commandments. Because that's what this is all about. So that's kind of our first leg of this. And again, I want you to think about that as a bit of a refresher of what I believe you already know about faith. And so in just a moment, we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about Acts 17 and who God is. So thank you.